imagine a group of really strict religious guardians, right? They are so terrified of losing their culture that they create this massive 39 rule system just to govern a single Saturday.
Yeah, it's pretty extreme.
Right. And then when a local rabbi publicly breaks one of those rules, these guardians don't just, you know, debate him. They actually team up with their absolute worst political enemies to assassinate him.
I mean, it sounds exactly like the plot of a high-stakes political thriller.
It really does.
But it's actually the precise historical reality recorded in one of the most famous ancient texts in the world.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are taking a comprehensive historical and textual look at Matthew chapter 12. And just to be clear right up front for you listening, our mission today isn't to preach a sermon or endorse a specific theology.
Right, we're putting our historian hats on for this one.
Exactly. We want to peel back the layers of a document that is often treated as, well, just a collection of simple Sunday school stories. Because when you actually examine the historical context, a very different picture emerges.
Oh, completely. It reveals this explosive first century political drama, a really fierce power struggle, and like you said, a shadowy murder conspiracy.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are dropping into a narrative that is essentially a massive turning point, right?
It is the absolute pivot point for the entire public ministry of Jesus, at least as it's presented in the text.
Because up until now, it's been pretty tame.
Yeah, I mean, up until chapter 12, the narrative shows a manageable level of friction. You have some grumbling, some theological disagreements between Jesus and the religious leaders.
Just standard rabbi debates.
Right. But this specific chapter marks a rapid, violent escalation. The text shifts from verbal criticism to an inescapable collision course toward an execution.
Wow.
Yeah, the temperature in the room goes from simmering to a full boil in a matter of hours.
But people don't just jump straight to a murder conspiracy over a minor disagreement. I mean, Jesus didn't just break a rule. He publicly humiliated the very people keeping a fragile peace in the region.
That's the key.
Before we can understand the explosion, we really have to look at the pressure cooker that caused it. First century Judea was not exactly a relaxed place to live.
Far from it. You really have to ground yourself in the suffocating reality of Roman occupation.
Yeah.
The Jewish people at this time are not a free, autonomous nation. They are living under the heavy boot of the Roman Empire.
They're paying exorbitant taxes.
Exactly. High taxes. And they're dealing with a constant, heavily armed military presence.
Yeah.
But perhaps most importantly, they are fighting this daily battle against cultural erasure.
And that fear of erasure didn't just start with the Romans. The historical context leading up to this moment includes a massive amount of collective trauma from previous empires.
Oh, absolutely. You have to remember what happened a couple of centuries prior under the Greeks.
The Syrian Greek king, right?
Yeah, Antiochus Epiphanes. During his reign, he literally tried to outlaw Judaism entirely. This wasn't just cultural pressure. It was a violent existential threat.
It's horrifying stuff.
It really is. He desecrated the sacred temple in Jerusalem. He massacred people simply for keeping the Sabbath day. And he tried to force total assimilation into Greek culture.
So it was basically a near-death experience for the Jewish religion.
Precisely. So when we look at the religious leaders in Matthew 12, specifically the Pharisees, we can't just view them as, you know, cartoon villains who love rules.
Right. They're carrying the immense psychological weight of that history.
That is a crucial point. The Pharisees essentially viewed themselves as the cultural and spiritual guardians of Judea. Their entire movement was born out of a post-exilic zeal.
They didn't want history to repeat itself.
Exactly. They looked back at the trauma of their history, all the exiles, the occupations, and they concluded, well, the reason we keep getting conquered as oppressed is because we don't follow the laws of the Torah strictly enough.
Like, God is punishing our laxity, which leads to a fascinating psychological reaction. Because if your core belief is that strict obedience is the absolute only thing keeping your nation from being wiped off the map, you aren't just going to follow the rules. You are going to build a fortress around them.
Yeah, they actually called it building a fence around the Torah.
A fence.
Yeah, the logic's pretty simple. If the actual law is a cliff edge, you don't want people walking right on the edge where they might slip. So you build a fence 50 feet back.
Oh, I see.
That way, even if you break a fence rule, you haven't broken the actual divine law.
I want to dig into how this mechanism actually worked, because the text highlights the Sabbath as the primary battleground.
Yes, it does.
The original Torah command is pretty straightforward, right? Keep the Sabbath day holy and do no work. But the Pharisees mutated that concept. They took the word work and expanded it into 39 specific granular categories of forbidden labor.
Yeah, and the level of micromanagement is staggering to modern ears. Under these 39 rules, you couldn't tie a knot. You couldn't write more than two letters of the alphabet.
Wait, really? Two letters?
Just two. You couldn't light a fire, which meant you couldn't cook. And, crucially for this chapter, you couldn't practice medicine.
Unless the person was actively dying, right?
Yeah, you're right. If it was a strictly acute, life-threatening condition, preserving life took precedence. But if someone had a chronic illness, like a bad back, a skin condition, or a withered hand,
they had to wait until the next day.
Exactly. Treating a chronic condition was categorized as practicing a trade, which was forbidden work.
When I look at how the system operated, it feels remarkably like an extreme homeowners association.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Think about it. An HOA starts out with a genuinely good premise, right? Let's keep the neighborhood nice. Let's protect our property values. Let's make sure everyone is safe.
Sure.
But give it a few years and suddenly the HOA board is out in your front yard measuring the length of your grass with a ruler to punish you with a fine.
Right.
It starts as a protective measure, but it mutates into a crushing legalistic burden on the common people.
That is a highly effective way to understand the dynamic. The Pharisee system started as a zealous defense of religious identity, but it morphed into this oppressive micromanagement structure. And the headquarters for this HOA board was the local synagogue.
Which is an interesting institution in itself, because if you look at the ancient texts, the synagogue doesn't even have a direct divine mandate in the original Torah.
No, it doesn't. The synagogue system developed much later, largely during the Babylonian exile, as a practical place for communities to gather when they didn't have access to the temple in Jerusalem.
Right.
But by the time we get to the first century, it has become the absolute center of Jewish social and religious life. I mean, it was the town hall, the school, the local court, and the place of worship all rolled into one.
Which perfectly sets up an incredibly volatile situation. If the synagogue is the absolute center of social life, and the Pharisees are the strict HOA board enforcing 39 unbreakable rules, what happens when someone publicly challenges those HOA rules right in front of everyone?
You get the powder keg explosion of Matthew 12.
And what's wild is that the catalyst for this massive political crisis isn't a grand armed rebellion. It starts with a seemingly innocent walk through a grain field.
Yeah, such an ordinary moment.
The narrative sets the scene. Jesus and his disciples are walking through a grain field on the Sabbath. They are hungry. The disciples reach out, pluck some heads of grain, rub them in their hands, and eat the kernels.
Right.
To us, that sounds entirely innocent, just grabbing a quick snack, but the Pharisees are watching.
And through the lens of those 39 rules, the Pharisees aren't seeing a snack. They're seeing a multi-count felony.
A felony over grain.
Yeah. By plucking the grain, the disciples are guilty of reaping. By rubbing it in their hands to separate the chaff, they are guilty of threshing and winnowing. And by eating it, they're preparing a meal.
That is like four major Sabbath violations committed in about 10 seconds.
Exactly. So the religious leaders immediately step in and accuse them of unlawfully harvesting.
But Jesus doesn't back down. He doesn't say, oh, my apologies, we didn't realize we were breaking the fence rules. He goes right to the core of the issue.
He really does.
He cites a historical precedent, bringing up King David, who is undeniably their greatest historical hero.
Hmm.
He points out that David once ate the consecrated bread in the temple when his men were hungry, bread that was strictly legally forbidden for anyone but the priests to consume.
It is a brilliant rhetorical counterattack.
Yeah.
He is using an argument from the lesser to the greater. If David, a human king, could bypass ritual law to satisfy human need, how much more can the figure standing in front of them do?
Right.
And the text shows Jesus using this precedent to drop a massive earth-shattering claim. He looks at these religious leaders, the ultimate terrifying authorities on the law, and he declares himself Lord of the Sabbath.
He is claiming authority over the exact day they have spent centuries trying to protect. He's essentially saying, I am the author of the rules you are currently trying to use against me.
Yes.
Within the context of this religious society, that is an overt claim to divine authority.
And he doesn't just leave it as an abstract theological debate out in a rural field. Because, you know, a debate in a field could be ignored.
Right. He takes the fight directly to their turf. The narrative moves them straight into the local synagogue, the absolute center of the Pharisees' power.
A town hall.
Exactly. And there happens to be a man there with a withered hand. And it is still the Sabbath.
Remember the medical rule, you can only heal if the person is actively dying. A withered hand is a chronic condition.
It's not life-threatening at all.
Not at all. the man has likely had it for years. By the Pharisees' rigid metrics, performing a healing today is practicing a trade. It is illegal.
So what does this all mean? Let me look at the logistics of this. Jesus could easily have told this man, hey, come back tomorrow. It's Tuesday. There's no Sabbath restrictions. I'll heal you then, right? Yeah. Why do it right then and there?
Yeah, he knows they're watching.
He knows it violates their specific rules.
Because the timing is the entire point. It is a deliberate, calculated provocation. He is intentionally forcing the religious leaders to look at the human cost of their legalism.
To put a face to the rules.
Exactly. The text says he asks them a direct question. Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?
And they refuse to answer him. So he heals the man anyway, right in front of the entire congregation. It is a total public exposure of their hypocrisy.
So it really is.
He proves in real time that showing mercy supersedes their rigid ritual strictness. In fact, earlier in the chapter, the text highlights Jesus quoting the ancient prophet Hosea to them, saying, I desire mercy and not sacrifice.
By quoting Hosea, Jesus is using their own revered scriptures to indict them. He's essentially telling them, you have memorized the textbook, but you have completely missed the diagnosis.
Wow.
They valued the purity of their intricate system over the physical restoration of a human being.
But by doing this, by claiming divine authority over their most sacred traditions, Jesus didn't just win a theological debate. He humiliated the cultural guardians in their own town hall.
Absolutely.
He threatened their immense social power. And, you know, desperate power brokers make incredibly dangerous alliances.
Which brings us to the really dark, violent turn in this text.
When you read Matthew 12:14, the tone of the entire narrative completely shifts. It says, but the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill him.
It's jarring.
Just let the speed of that escalation sink in. We went from a theological silence over picking grain to a desperate, shadowy plot to destroy him in the span of a single afternoon.
What's fascinating here is that it isn't just the intent to murder. It's the logistics of how they plan to do it. Historical records surrounding this event show that to pull this off, the Pharisees formed a shocking political alliance.
Yeah, they crossed deeply drawn ideological lines to team up with a group called the Herodians. I was looking into the background of this alliance, and what blows my mind is who these Herodians actually were. They were essentially Roman collaborators, right?
Precisely. They were a political faction that supported the puppet Herodian dynasty, the family of King Herod, who ruled Judea purely on behalf of the Roman Empire.
So they embraced Hellenistic culture.
Yeah, they compromised with the occupying empire, and their primary objective was maintaining the Roman peace so they could keep their own wealth and social status intact.
So they are the exact polar opposite of the Pharisees. The Pharisees were strict anti-Roman, anti-assimilation purists. To a Pharisee, a Herodian was a complete sellout.
A traitor to the Jewish identity, really.
These two groups hated each other.
They were natural, bitter enemies.
It is exactly like watching two bitterly opposed modern political parties, you know, the kind that spend all day on cable news tearing each other apart.
Right. Accusing the other of destroying the country.
Exactly. And then a charismatic third party candidate emerges who starts completely dismantling both of their platforms and drawing massive crowds. Suddenly, these two bitter enemies are sitting in a smoky back room, shaking hands, making a backroom deal to take the new guy out.
That is exactly the dynamic at play. It is a bipartisan hit squad. And you have to understand the motive behind it. Why would these deeply entrenched enemies suddenly unite?
It all comes back to Rome, doesn't it?
It all comes back to the suffocating presence of Roman rule and profound political fear.
Because Jesus was drawing massive crowds. The text says his messianic popularity was growing rapidly.
Yes. He is performing miracles, drawing thousands of people, and openly challenging the established authorities. Both the Pharisees and the Herodians were terrified that if this movement grew too large, it would spark a popular, uncontrolled uprising among the common people.
And if there is an uprising, Rome doesn't send diplomats to negotiate. Rome sends legions to crush it.
Exactly. A violent Roman crackdown would destroy the fragile political stability of the entire region. The Herodians would lose their political power and wealth, and the Pharisees would lose their religious freedom, or worse, their lives and their temple.
So they apply a brutal political calculus to preserve their institutions. This one rabbi from Galilee has to die.
That's the tragic reality of it.
With a unified, bipartisan hit squad now plotting his murder, Jesus takes an unexpected pivot. The text notes that instead of forcing an immediate armed confrontation, he withdraws.
He steps back.
Yeah, he steps back from the major towns and continues his healing ministry quietly. He actually tells people not to broadcast what he's doing. And the narrative points out that this is a direct fulfillment of an ancient prophecy from Isaiah, the prophecy of a gentle, justice-bringing servant who won't quarrel or cry out in the streets.
He fundamentally refuses to play their political game. He doesn't raise an army to fight the Romans or the Pharisees. He just keeps healing the broken people that the system discarded.
But of course, the establishment won't let it go.
No, they can't let a threat to their authority simply walk away.
So they track him down again. The Pharisees and the scribes confront him, and this time they demand a miraculous trick. They say, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you."
Which is incredibly audacious.
Right. He just healed a man's paralyzed hand in front of them. What more do they want?
They want validation on their own terms. They are demanding that he perform a parlor trick that fits into their specific approved parameters of what a prophet should look like.
But because Jesus knows they are already plotting his murder, he completely rejects their demand. He refuses to perform on demand. Instead, the text says he gives them what is known as the sign of Jonah.
And the sign of Jonah is a profound moment in the text.
Yeah.
Jesus says, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth."
Within the narrative structure, this is a direct, undeniable foreshadowing of his own death and resurrection.
Absolutely.
He is basically looking his assassins in the eye and saying, "I know exactly what you are planning, and my death is going to be the ultimate sign." But he doesn't stop there. He delivers a brutal historical indictment. I'll read how the text frames it in Matthew 12.41. "The men of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now something greater than Jonah is here."
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you have to realize the sheer magnitude of the insult to a first century Pharisee.
Oh, they must have been furious.
Oh, beyond furious. Nineveh was the capital of the ancient Assyrian Empire. They were brutal, pagan, Gentile oppressors. They were the historic bad guys of the Jewish narrative.
And Jesus is warning the religious elite that those ancient, brutal pagans are going to be the ones judging them at the end of time.
Yes, because when Jonah, a very reluctant prophet, preached a tiny five-word sermon in Nineveh, the text says the entire pagan city repented.
Jesus is pointing out the tragic irony. I am standing right in front of you, performing miracles, offering divine mercy, someone vastly greater than Jonah, and instead of repenting, you are actively plotting to murder me.
The text also notes he brings up the Queen of Sheba, another ancient Gentile who traveled from the ends of the earth just to hear the wisdom of King Solomon. And Jesus declares to the Pharisees that someone greater than Solomon is here.
By claiming to be greater than Jonah, the great prophet, and greater than Solomon, the great king, the narrative presents Jesus as boldly declaring himself the ultimate fulfillment of all their history.
He is claiming the mantle of the Davidic king and the ultimate prophet.
Yes, he is.
Here's where it gets really interesting. He is pointing out that this entire religious system, this protective HOA that mutated into a ruthless political machine, had prioritized its own pious reputation and political safety over God's actual desire for mercy.
It is a profound tragedy. This sequence of events locks Jesus and the religious establishment into an inescapable collision course. There is no turning back after Matthew 12.
Wow.
The shadow of the cross is now permanently cast over the rest of the text.
It is a remarkable, intense look at the intersection of power, fear, and religion. As we wrap up this deep dive, looking at all these sources, what is a final thought that stands out to you?
Well, the Pharisees started with a legitimate desire to protect their faith and identity from being erased by Rome. We talked about that trauma.
Right, it came from a real place.
Exactly. But the rigid system morphed so entirely that out of fear of a Roman crackdown, they allied with their oppressors to kill the one person offering them mercy.
Yeah.
It forces you to ask, when a system becomes entirely obsessed with its own preservation, does it inevitably destroy the very core of what it was built to protect?
Wow. Does the obsession with preservation destroy the core? That is a heavy, incredibly relevant thought to walk away with. And we want to hear from you. Drop a comment below with your thoughts on today's historical drama. Like, were the Pharisees just terrified politicians making a desperate, pragmatic move to save their nation from Rome? Or had they completely lost their moral compass along the way? Let us know what you think. And hey, If you enjoyed this deep dive, make sure to like and subscribe to the channel so you never miss an exploration. Also, don't forget to check the description below for exclusive links related to today's source material. The next episode will be even more intense.